Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some interesting articles from the November-December issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note. Happy to have you. By Hunter Hawk. It was a much-anticipated holiday adventure in the eyes of the CNI staff. Every December, the Wrangler National Finals Rodeo roared into Las Vegas. Many of us left our North Texas homes on planes, some left in giant trucks full of magazines and merch, and headed for the party town. We weren't going for the purpose of cutting loose, though. We were Vegas-bound to take in the sights, the sounds, and the excitement that always surrounded WNFR. World-class championship rodeo action every night, iconic country music performances with headliners like George Strait and Reba, the unique offerings of the entire Western industry at the holiday markets. All were highlights, as were the interactions in our cowboy Christmas booth, and at our special rodeo watch parties with fans and readers at the Silverton. While it was a must to have rooms booked during WNFR, none of us were certain just how much time we'd be in them. The experience would have been downright exhausting had it not been so much fun. This year, plenty of fun will still be had, but like every other part of 2020, it'll be different. With the global pandemic still not under control at crucial decision deadlines, the WNFR couldn't exactly make the usual splash in Vegas. Instead, this year's event, December 3rd through the 12th, will be spread out over two entertainment-rich towns in North Texas. Fans of rodeo will see the best of the best compete nightly at Globe Life Field in Arlington, and daytime shoppers and nighttime revelers will fan out to Fort Worth because there's no better Western landing spot than the historic stockyards. The WNFR's one-year-only move out of Vegas brings mixed emotions. We'll, of course, miss those neon nights, and we'll look forward to a triumphant return. But we're thrilled to have one of the biggest events of any year move this close to CNI's North Texas headquarters. We'll be making the most of it, setting up our fan booth in the Fort Worth stockyards. It feels so good to say this. Come by and see us. And if you can't make it to the North Texas edition of WNFR physically, you can feel like you're part of the action by reading our coverage at cowboysandindians.com. We'll have rodeo highlights, best bets for attendees, and lots of great images to share. Beyond WNFR, let CNI be your online holiday home by checking out our special social media and signing up for our weekly e-newsletter. Throughout this season, we'll keep things festive with decor ideas, delicious recipes, inspiring musical playlists, classic Western movie recommendations, and more. There'll even be an expanded online version of this issue's gift guide. Whether we see you at WNFR or online, we'd like to wish you and yours a happy, healthy time together. The Art Gallery. Michaela Jones. The great-great-granddaughter of Chief Tutawa of the Tossawitty Shoshone tribe, Michaela Jones has been creating works inspired by her Shoshone culture for more than two decades. She grew up on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, 100 miles northeast of Elko, Nevada, and considers her rural upbringing and family heritage the foundation and inspiration for her vibrant work. An enrolled member of the Timok tribe of Western Shoshone, Joan calls herself a self-taught artist. She spent years trying different techniques, textures, and colors, painting what she saw in her mind's eye. Her goal is to connect with people through pieces that tell a story, either about nature or her culture. Animals and totems are at the heart of her bold paintings, which are also available as signed and hand-embellished limited edition Gicklies. Joan's award-winning work has been shown across the country and is in the permanent collections of the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno, Nevada, and Northeastern Nevada Museum in Elko. Her work can also be seen at galleries in Red Lodge, Montana, and St. George, Utah. Some of her larger pieces are featured at the Four Seasons Resort, Rancho Encantado, Santa Fe. Also in Santa Fe, she was honored in 2017 with Indian Markets Design Fellowship Award, which saw her work emblazoned on all official market merchandise. We talked with Jones about her studio in Elko, where she was sheltering in place with her husband and their five children, and working on some personal pieces. C&I. You were raised on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation near Elko, Nevada. How have the cultural influences of your upbringing inspired your work? Michaela Jones. I feel so inspired and grounded when I'm there. The colors and styles I use are all inspired from growing up on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, which is 100 miles from the nearest town. My dad and I always were hunting and fishing, and the valley we lived in was so beautiful. The colors I use are inspired from growing up there, and of course, from my grandmother's stories, even though she didn't have the opportunity to share her culture. Every time I paint something, I feel honored to paint the things that she could not express. Animals and totems are important to the Shoshone and Paiute nations, where you spent your youth. What animals have you most drawn upon in your work? I'm very drawn to buffalo. They are such majestic animals, powerful and very important to our tribe. One of our sons' middle name is Buffalo. I love their power, strength, and energy, and feel like I have a special connection with them, an almost symbiotic relationship. But I also have a growling tiger on my sight. When you and your family were sheltering in place last spring, you had time to return to several personal works that you'd been too busy to complete because you'd been consumed with shows and commission pieces. Tell us about one of the pieces you've been able to make time for. The canceling of Santa Fe Indian Market in August sort of took the wind out of my sails, and I used the month of April to regroup and went back to a mermaid piece that I had sketched out in 2017. We have property in Baja California near the water, and my daughter wanted me to paint us a mermaid using the shells we collected on the beach. This piece is totally outside the box for me, but I'm really enjoying it. Your work is so vibrant and textured. Tell us a bit about your technique and materials. I start with a sketch and then move on to texture. I primarily paint with acrylics. I then layer with gesso and take different tools, including palette knives, combs, and even hair dryer attachments. This process produces a lot of light and captures the glow from within, which is especially evident in my teepee pieces. In addition to your original work, you also sell limited edition Gicklies with band detailing. What made you decide to branch out into Gicklies? This is an affordable option for collectors who may not be able to afford my original work. Each piece is gallery wrapped. I personally embellish each piece, and we can frame them as well. Late 2020 seems like it's going to be a very exciting time for you. I understand you have a clothing line in the works. After last year's Indian market, several of us Plains Indians were approached to work on a fashion line based on our work, and that's moving forward. I have my art printed on fabric already, am working on jackets as well, and anticipate we will have our first fashion show in the late fall. I am also working on my 2021 calendar, which always sells out in the first month of the year. Z.S. Liang. It's a long way from childhood poverty in the 1950s China of Chairman Mao to the American dream in the affluent Los Angeles suburb of Agoura Hills. The talented paintbrush of Z.S. Liang has taken him on that remarkable journey. Today, that artistic trek takes viewers of his award-winning oil paintings back in time for a close-up look at the lives of the Plains Indians of the 19th century. I try to record the Indian as a hero, as a positive figure, Liang says at his home studio. Whereas Frederick Remington's narratives featured frontiersmen caught in a desperate last stand, Liang's focus is on the native warriors encircling those intruders in a desperate fight for their very way of life. The images are packed with historical detail, like the circle a brave would paint around the eye of his war horse. That means a horse can see better, Liang explains. The stripes on a horse mean counting coup, touch the enemy. All this indicates a great chief, not an ordinary person. Liang has been drawing since he was old enough to pick up a pencil. Creativity was in his genes. His father was an artist, his mother a musician. As a boy of six, his drawing of a local celebration was published in a magazine. That was in 1959, during an era of limited and suspicion-filled relations with Communist China. But as a child, Liang never felt oppressed. When you live there, you don't feel it, he says. Later on, when I came here, I saw the difference. He attended Beijing's Central Academy of Fine Arts before coming to America in 1982 to pursue a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting at Massachusetts College of Art and an MFA in Painting at Boston University. But the following decade, the future American citizen was a successful and award-winning portrait and commercial artist. A visit to a living history museum outside of Boston would forever change the focus of Liang's art and the direction of his life. At the Plymouth Plantation, he was fascinated by Native Americans realistically portraying the Wampanoag Indians of the 1600s. It opened a new world, Liang says, and from there I just learned so much about the Indian. His work ever since has focused primarily on the final century of the free-roaming Lakota, Arapaho, Blackfeet, and Cheyenne, those traumatic years of change on the Great Plains between the days of Lewis and Clark and the final shots of the Indian Wars. The painter has visited many reservation homelands of those tribes, met their elders, and participated in their ceremonies. Adorning his home studio are pieces collected on those trips that look as if they date from the 1800s. The buckskin war shirts, headdresses, modified Winchesters, medicine bags, and other items serve as accurate models and lend the authenticity that pervades Liang's canvases. Most are recreations made by modern native artists, but Liang has even made some replicas himself. I have to learn to make them to understand their way of life, he says. I try to make everything as real as possible. All the customs, the details. As much as possible, it's real. Liang's paintings take you inside the villages, the lodges, and the families of that bygone era, portraying the people who followed the buffalo as the unique individuals they were. He might paint a young family in a busy village showing off their newborn son, a grandfather encouraging a departing soldier warrior, or a mother teaching her young daughter to sew. Domestic scenes like these give way to representations of the dramatic conflict that once raged across the plains. A painting that portrays a galloping decoy of horseback warriors leading the hated bluecoats into a trap brings to mind something Sitting Bull's great-grandson Ernie LaPointe observed about Liang's work. The strokes of his paintbrush tell our story. Z.S.'s paintings capture the true images of his subjects. You'll find these words in Z.S. Liang, Native Trails, Fresh Tracks, the first retrospective book on the artist. In its pages and on his canvases, you can still travel back to the days when the buffalo and those who followed them were free. 30 years of Double D Ranch. Known for its high style and iconic fashion tributes to the West, the Double D Ranch brand has garnered admirers from every walk of life. Celebrating 30 years in business, founders Audrey Franz and Cheryl McMullen share what has kept the flame burning through three decades of design. By Andrea Thorpe. Even after 30 years in the Western apparel industry, Audrey Franz and Cheryl McMullen, fearless leaders of the Double D Ranch brand, are still blazing a trail and have the stories to prove it. It was like 2 or 3 weeks before the Grammys, and she's like, "Oh yeah, I need something to wear," Franz recalls of one of the duo's recent adventures. The she in question is Tanya Tucker, by the way. Franz at Moon Mullen custom outfitted her for the red carpet and after parties on music's biggest night. Reminiscing about the Grammy whirlwind produces many laughs as the sisters talk about the handmade suits lost in the mail, flying in a yard of fabric for last-minute alterations, and the grand festivity known as a celebrity dress fitting. The memories roll on from the Staples Center in Los Angeles to Broadway in Nashville, with Tucker still the main character. "We were shooting at her barn and her horses when they picked up a shirt and said, 'This needs to be shot on Broadway,'" McMullen recalls. "So she loads everybody up on her show bus, and I'm like, 'Oh my gosh, we're going downtown to Broadway with Tanya Tucker.'" These stories could reel in the attention of any country music admirer, but Franz and McMullen count them as another page of Double D Ranch history, a legacy they never knowingly set out to create. One anecdote they've told innumerable times is their origin story, a tale of an Indian blanket coat designed that unintentionally launched their iconic Western apparel brand. "We decided we were all going to go snow skiing in Taos on a super tight budget. I mean, we all piled into a 2-room motel room," McMullen recalls. "I came down off the mountain into Taos and got a glance of this man in the Indian blanket coat in the grocery store aisle. Later that night at the dinner table, McMullen brought up the coat sighting, catching the ear of a nearby table. This man from another table told me, 'Oh, run down to this store and he'll make you a blanket coat.' Following the man's advice, McMullen had her own blanket coat made and brought it back to Texas. As soon as her father saw the Southwestern souvenir, he told her to take the design to market. With the original maker's blessing, Franz and McMullen prepared to present the piece to market buyers. 'We had a great little presentation there at Dallas Market, and then it just took off,' McMullen says. 'We didn't even know what we were doing, but people were placing orders, and it just got crazy. With the hype of the original blanket coat still buzzing, people were already wondering what the sisters would be bringing to market next, even though they hadn't planned on returning. We were hoping to raise enough money to fund our ski trip for the next year. And that was it,' McMullen says with a laugh. While the birth of Double D Ranch wasn't planned, The growth of the brand was certainly not by accident. The sisters were raised authentically Western and have used their many adventures as creative fodder for fashion collections from season to season. In fact, the underlying themes of their 30th anniversary collection all pay homage to the people, places, and experiences dear to the Double D Ranch brand and those standing behind it. Dubbed I Go Back, the fall collection is full of hidden significance from colorways to garment names. As McMullen elaborates, it's going back and looking at things that have influenced Double D Ranch for the past 30 years. What has influenced our design's aesthetic? What has put us here? In pondering that question, Franz and McMullen have dug into the roots of the journey to this milestone, noting every moment that signified a turning point or a nudge of encouragement in business as well as life. Some of these influences stem from their South Texas upbringing, with deep family connections to both the people and the land. Others come from an appreciation of culture discovered through years of study and travel. To understand how these broad themes materialize in well-thought-out design, one must only listen to Franz and McMullen explain the vision of each of the four collections within I Go Back. Matagorda. Matagorda basically represents Audrey, our sister, Hetty, and my growing up years. It's very 70s influence, as well as by the places we've traveled. Lots of quarter horse racing and Native American history comes in, and because we were so close to the Mexican border, Mexican influence comes in as well. Cody. Cody is based around not only Buffalo Bill Cody, the showman, but also a trip we took to Cody, Wyoming, to the Buffalo Bill Museum early in our business years. That trip and museum have influenced our aesthetic and design throughout the past 30 years. Nashville. Nashville is basically the soundtrack to us growing up. Not only the music coming out of Nashville, but also the outfits. Think nudie suits, things like that. Taos. Taos is where we originally started and got the blanket coat idea. The collection, again, is influenced by Native American blanket patterns, Melissa Rogers, and the Melissa Rogers Museum in Taos. While the design direction points to retro motifs in I Go Back, the collection is designed from a clean slate, no direct recreations. I didn't want to go back and repeat anything that we've done in the past, McMullen says. There are little nods throughout each collection to the original blanket coat or the original scout jacket. It will look familiar, but it will also look fresh. Even after 30 years of knockout collections, Double D Ranch continues to stump marketers with its ability to innovate and create in such a small niche as Western apparel. We've never been able to put a label on what Double D is, McMullen says. There is definitely a rock and roll influence to it. There's a Western influence to it. There's Spanish, Native American, Americana. It's a part of our heritage and who we are. It's truly our DNA. As for the woman wearing the clothes, McMullen has her more defined. I think she's a very strong, daring woman. I think she's not afraid to put on a jacket with fringe or a pair of statement boots. Our customer is not a wildflower. Nothing speaks to that definition of the Double D Ranch customer quite like the group of women Franz and McMullen have pulled together on social media, specifically concentrated on their Double D Addiction page on Facebook that boasts over 6,000 members. The Double D Addiction page has been really great for us to see real people wearing the clothes and seeing how they're putting things together, Franz says. Market research aside, the group has served as a meeting place for women and even a few men who admire the Double D Ranch brand and the culture around it. Members share favorite pieces from their personal collections, seek style advice, and get a first look at upcoming designs during live collection reveals. Real-life friendships have been developed as Addiction members travel together to Double D Ranch headquarters in Yoakum, Texas, or on group retreats throughout the year. To all who appreciate its no-wallflower culture that connects free-spirited women everywhere, the brand signifies something more than the clothes on their backs and the boots on their feet. It's the spirit of the West itself, and the community it creates. Looking at what might lie ahead on the horizon of the next 30 years, Franz and McMullen seem steady in their vision. It's all about staying true to their roots, their quality, their Double D Ranch community, and the Western culture they lift up with each passing collection. Black Beauty rides again. With the new adaptation of Black Beauty coming to Disney Plus, director Ashley Avis and actors Kate Winslet, Lane Green, and Mackenzie Foy prove there are still good horse movies to be made. By Elizabeth K. McCall. When our producers wanted to remake Black Beauty, they wanted two things to modernize the story and to make Black Beauty female, says Ashley Avis, who directed it and wrote the screenplay for the new adaptation of the classic horse tale due out on Disney Plus late this year. The producers got their wish, and more. Produced by Constantine Film and JB Pictures, the newly reimagined Black Beauty revolves around a wild Mustang born in the American West, captured, and taken from her family, and Jo Green, a 17-year-old girl grieving the loss of both parents, who is healed by the horse-human bond. It stars Oscar winner Kate Winslet, voicing the inner thoughts of the horse, Mackenzie Foy as Jo Green, and Leon Glenn, a horse whisperer, John Manley. Having grown up with the book, which had such a big impact on my life, I wanted to honor as many parallels as I could find in a modern light, the original characters, the messages, Avis says. What I did not want to do was just take the idea and change everything. She struggled the most with the origin of the titular horse. What would be the parallel now of an 1800s carriage horse in London? In researching Anna Sewell's 1877 novel, Avis discovered that the English writer's mission was to improve the treatment of horses of her day by writing a story that would help people empathize with the plight of the animals in Victorian England. She was a trailblazer for the horses of her time, Avis says. Reading about the wild horse issue and what is going on now, I felt like we could do the same thing with Black Beauty to help horses of our time. In our version, Beauty was born a wild horse, was rounded up in the American West, and taken away from her family. She then goes to Birtwick Stables, and we introduce the world of those characters from the book in a more modern light. Sewell's novel is now almost 150 years old. Although she intended it for adults, mainly to engender kindness and sympathy in people who worked with horses in Victorian England, it's today considered a children's classic and remains a best-selling children's novel. One of the first novels in the English language to be told from an animal's point of view, the story foreshadowed natural horsemanship in its advocacy for kinder, gentler treatment of horses, and its view that animals are not just beasts of burden, but sentient beings who are able to develop a rapport with humans. Black Beauty resonated with Avis, who read the book as a child and never forgot the message it imparted and the mission it ultimately called her to. Avis grew up a horse-crazy kid and started riding at 7, but horses had been absent from her life for almost a decade when she first met producer Jeremy Bolt. "I wasn't sure what we were going to end up talking about," Ava says. "We just had this beautiful conversation about what inspired us to go into film and what made me want to become a writer and a director, and my two greatest passions, storytelling and horses." During that initial conversation, Avis mentioned the impact a mystical beach scene in another horse film, The Black Stallion, had on her as a girl. He said, "My partner and I have wanted to remake Black Beauty for 10 years. If you have a take, let me know." I went home, and 10 days later, I presented this 40-page long pitch. It was just the perfect fit at the right time. Originally set to film in Canada, the production moved to South Africa after Avis had already begun scouting locations in North America. The movie was shot in 2019 in and around Cape Town and in the wine country of Stellenbosch. One of the main locations was in the Red Rock country of Picketburg, outside of Cape Town. Luckily, I'd been to Cape Town a few times before and knew the landscape would fit perfectly with the American West, says Avis, who had previously been on location in Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada for an independent documentary. While filming an actual wild horse roundup in Nevada from a hilltop using a 1,000-millimeter lens with a doubler, Avis spotted a young colt separated from his mother by a low-flying helicopter. Deeply moved, she vowed to do something. Before leaving for South Africa to shoot Black Beauty, she adopted the colt and his dam from the Bureau of Land Management. The experience helped shape the new Beauty's origin story. It also provided virtually seamless footage for the new film. "When I was putting together the footage we got in Picketburg, South Africa, with the footage we got in Utah, filming the real Onaqui herd, even the grass was almost identical. It was almost like a gift that we were on the right track trying to put forth the right message," she says. "Our producers couldn't tell what was filmed in South Africa and what was filmed in the West." Through editing, Avis was able to merge footage of a young foal cast as young Wild Beauty in South Africa together with the real Onaqui herd she'd filmed, making it appear as if they were an actual family, only feet apart. The pulse beating through Black Beauty quickened when Avis's script reached second-generation movie horse trainer Cody Rawson-Harris in Mount White, New South Wales, Australia. "The film would not be the same without the work that Cody did," Avis says. "When I read the script, I was about 8 pages in, and I said, 'I've got to do this,'" says Rawson-Harris, who stepped onto his first film set at age 7 and has worked 30-plus years preparing animals and educating the actors working with them for feature films, TV series such as the Australian classic The Man from Snowy River, and commercials around the world. His role on the crew of Black Beauty was the all-important Liberty horse trainer. Like a conductor leading an orchestra, a Liberty trainer directs an unrestrained horse from a distance using body language, whip cues, and voice. The slightest point of a finger can prompt a head turn. Raised arms can signal a rear, other signals to advance or halt. The animal is literally at liberty to participate or leave. "Fortunately, I'd done a job before in South Africa," Rawson-Harris says. He caught a flight from Australia to Cape Town, landed at 11 p.m., and got straight into it, training horses at 8 the next morning. First on the agenda was meeting the horses who would be playing Beauty. 4 thoroughbred former racehorses named Jenny, Rosie, Spirit, and Awards, all young mares who were between 4 and 6. A veteran movie horse named Indiana, a gelding, also occasionally stepped in to portray Beauty, despite some physical differences. Jenny would be the main Black Beauty who would interact with Foy. Spirit would play the wild Black Beauty. Jenny was the only true black one, Rawson Harris says. The rest were dark brown or bay, so we ended up dyeing them and putting a star on. Never before exposed to film sets, the horses were selected through a virtual equine casting process from photos and videos sent by the South African horse team to Rawson Harris and Avis before he left Australia and even before he had met the director. The trainer's affinity for tight schedules matched the lean production schedule, around 15 or 16 weeks total, counting 8 weeks of pre-production. Rawson Harris had about 2 months to prepare the horses when he arrived. I was used to having to think quick on my feet to make things work. This wasn't your typical Hollywood film, rehearsing horses on the beach for 2 or 3 days before we shoot. Almost every location we went, we virtually had to rehearse in the morning and shoot that day. To achieve what we did on this film, I think was extraordinary. Everything we did with Black Beauty was all trained. That's what I was there to do, train for the camera. Extraordinary is also the word Avis uses to describe what Rawson Harris was able to get the horses to do in the film. It was built from trust and love, she says. Both Foy and Glenn arrived with some prior horse experience. Leon rode almost a decade for Game of Thrones, and Mackenzie in The Nutcracker and The Forever Realms, Ava says. We were so fortunate to have actors in Leon and Mackenzie who were very passionate about the message of the story and wanted to do all that work. Foy became so hooked on horses that she has continued riding since the movie wrapped. The safety of both the human and animal actors was paramount on the set. An animal welfare inspector from Animal Issues Matter, a registered animal welfare organization in South Africa, was there at all times along with a veterinarian. Jenny was the better one to have around the actors, even though we used all the horses, Rawson Harris says. She was predominantly on the slow scenes, even though she did a lot of fast stuff as well as riding. She was the safest horse to be around Mackenzie when we had to have the horse rear and look soft and slow. It's always challenging to train a horse for a film set, but if you have prior preparation, nothing that comes to you is unexpected. The only thing unexpected is the environment when you turn up. When you get to the beach, it's how soft is the sand? How cold is the wind? Which way is it coming? Oh, this horse has never seen a wave before. Those are the things that wake you up in the morning and you go, let's get there early and make a game plan. Rawson Harris had been training the horses in South Africa for about 2 weeks when Avis arrived on set. When you hear the directors coming, hopefully they like what you're doing, he says. You've got to stick with what you know, and your heart tells you what you should do. On their first meeting, Rawson Harris took Avis straight to the round pen to do a join-up process together with a horse. I think that was the thing that helped Ashley and me connect. It was a joy to train and then be able to collaborate with Ashley. It was a blessing. The feeling was mutual. Avis says Rawson Harris helped her find the themes she was searching for. The thing I really want people to understand watching Black Beauty is what Anna Sewell wanted to do, make people understand that horses feel love and loss and heartbreak and joy. When Cody said the goal of his work was to help each horse find his peace, I immediately opened my laptop and I wrote that into the script. Cody's influence became the character of Lee and Glenn's John in many ways. The way Cody worked with these horses, through that love and connection and finding that peace together, rang true to me as the heart and soul of what we were trying to convey, especially when you're talking about a horse that's been taken away from her family. Working on Black Beauty was revelatory for director and trainer alike. The experience restored Rawson Harris's faith in the movie business. I've worked with a lot of different producers. I've worked with a lot of good directors, he says. the difference on this movie compared to what my life experiences in the industry are is something I've been searching for, that special collaboration. In this industry of make-believe, there was something so real about this. I was losing faith, to be quite honest, that something like this would even exist. Sometimes it's the long time between drinks for these type of projects to come along. I hope this project shines the light that Ashley wants. If it strikes a chord with people and they want to see more of it, mission accomplished. For Avis, it was both a mission and an expiation. I felt so guilty because I grew up riding and I didn't know what was going on with wild horses being rounded up in the West. The film's greater theme is making people understand the emotions horses feel and trying to find that parallel with Anna Sewell doing great things for horses in her time and us trying to do great things for horses today. What moved her to make the film and what continues to stir her as she anticipates the reception when Black Beauty begins streaming soon is the heartfelt desire to truly help. We're illuminating a prevalent issue, Ava says. I think the movie will be enjoyed by people of all ages, and I'm really hopeful that the message about wild horses will resonate. It's a comfort-filled Christmas at Perini Ranch. Holidays in Texas with famed steak maestros Tom and Lisa Perini call for a crackling fire, some roasted prime rib, and plenty of bubbly. By Elise Pierce. From the festive deep red New Mexico ristras hung on its patios to the old-fashioned multicolored Christmas lights strung on all its buildings, Perini Ranch Steakhouse serves up the holidays with extra sides of nostalgia. Tom and Lisa Perini live on the 600-acre ranch in Buffalo Gap, Texas, 14 miles southwest of Abilene, and run the place. It's grown into a compound with several businesses, their world-renowned steakhouse, catering company, mail-order beef tenderloin business, and the country market, where you can shop for home goods and kitchenware and popular Perini Ranch items, including their cookbooks, steak and rib rubs, and cool Perini swag like custom-designed Buffalo Gap t-shirts. For those who might want to spend the night, there are two guest houses on the property, too. If you're going the few miles into town or heading to nearby Abilene State Park for some lake time, there's the Gap Cafe by Perini Ranch, where the coffee is big city. The pastries are homemade, and the chicken fried steaks made with ribeye. For as long as the couple's been in business, 37 years now, families have been making the drive out west to eat their certified Angus beef, served up in steaks and burgers hailed by many as some of the best in the state, if not the country. Over time, they've amassed a cult-like following. In 2002, when George W. Bush was president, Perini and his team set up on the White House lawn and catered the congressional picnic. They've also cooked for renowned chef Jacques Pepin and friends Billy Bob Thornton, cutting horse icon Buster Welch, and Tanya Tucker often stopped by. Recipients of the esteemed James Beard Award for America's Classics, the Perinis recently released their second cookbook devoted to their simple Texas-inspired recipes, Perini Ranch Steakhouse, Stories and Recipes and Real Texas Food, Comanche Moon Publishing. We caught up with Tom and Lisa one afternoon between lunch and dinner service and got a big helping of their West Texas holiday cheer. What's the first impression someone gets when they come to Perini Ranch for the holidays? Lisa. When you get out of the car, the aroma is amazing. We cook everything over a mesquite live fire, and the smell of steaks cooking and mesquite wood burning is as comforting as you can get. We also mix in a little New Mexico pinon at Christmas time. It makes me happy. Tom. When you walk in, there's a big fireplace right inside the front door. You can get a drink at the bar and go outside to sit at the outdoor fireplace if you need to wait for a table. We have blankets that you can wrap up on. CNI. Ah, drinks. What are some of your favorite holiday cocktails? Lisa. If it's early in the day, an eggnog or a bourbon milk punch. A hot toddy is always fun by the fireplace in the evening. How does an easy hors d'oeuvre go with? What would you suggest? Cheddar pecan cheese straws are the ultimate cocktail snack. You can make a batch and freeze them and pull them out when you have guests. There's just enough spice that it makes you want to have another cocktail, and that's never bad. Okay, on to dinner. Tell us about how the menu at Perini Ranch Steakhouse reflects the holiday season. We're all about beef, so of course meat is the center of the plate. We have seasonal side dishes like the roasted corn and poblano pepper pudding, roasted acorn squash, bourbon glazed carrots, and the pear cranberry crisp for dessert. Our menu is always comforting, but the holidays make it even more so. What do the two of you look forward to most during the holidays? Throughout the celebration of the holidays, we're always working when people are playing. So when things are starting to wrap up, the night before Christmas Eve, we have a handful of close friends and family that come over. We've probably been doing this 10 or 12 years now. We bring in a sack of East Coast oysters, and we shuck oysters and stand out back in the freezing cold near the barbecue pit, and we eat oysters and we drink champagne. We also might make a gumbo and put sausages in the pit, but oysters are the center part of this. We're in the beef business, so for this one day, we don't have beef, and it's a thrill to have oysters. It's really nice. Christmas itself must be a pretty low-key, then. What do you do for Christmas? We have tamales for Christmas morning breakfast. There's a great little place in Abilene, and you go through a major ordeal to order them, but it's worth it. Usually it's tamales and champagne. We highly recommend the tradition. We started it years ago, and it's worked out really well. Do you have a holiday movie you always watch? A Christmas Story is one with the little boy and the Red Ryder BB gun. This time period is the late 30s, early 40s, and all he wants for Christmas is this BB gun. The mother says, no, you'll shoot your eye out. And the teacher says, no, you'll shoot your eye out. It comes on every Christmas day, and we watch it while we're having tamales and champagne, sitting in front of the fireplace with our basset hounds. Lisa. One's named Gus, after Captain Gus McCrae in Lonesome Dove. Robert Duvall, who is a friend of ours, wasn't impressed. The other's Jet, after James Dean's character, Jet Rink, in the movie Giant. Wait a minute. One of your basset hounds is named after a James Dean character? Tom. His personality matches it perfectly. Perini Holiday Cheer. Champagne of choice. Our friends at Fess Parker Winery and Vineyard in Los Olivos, California, make a fabulous sparkling wine, Festivity. And for a serious treat, it's Billicart Salmon Brut Rosé. Stocking stuffers. Tom has a pretty serious sweet tooth, so you'll sure find toffee from Susie's South 40 Confections in Midland, Texas, in his stocking. As for special pet treats, our dogs are so spoiled, they think it's Christmas every day. By the fire. Tom really enjoys classic movies, especially classic westerns. Think John Wayne. I'll be reading a book or clipping recipes from magazines with the intention of trying them soon. Merry relaxation. Christmas Day is probably a lazy afternoon with a nap, some quality dog snuggling, and Christmas music. We just enjoy being in our home and being together. That's a special day. Visit Perini Ranch Steakhouse online at periniranch.com. Here are some recipes from the Perini Ranch Holiday Menu. Ranch Roasted Prime Rib. Serves 8 or more. Prime Rib Rub. 1/2 cup coarsely ground black pepper. 1/4 cup kosher salt. 1 tablespoon plus 1 teaspoon garlic powder. 1 tablespoon plus 1 teaspoon crumbled dried oregano. 1 4-rib roast, prime rib, about 8 pounds, bones removed. Logs to fuel a wood-burning smoker, mesquite if available. For a special occasion, few cuts of beef are more visually striking than a prime rib roast. You ought to see it when we lay out 40 of them side by side for big parties. At the Perini Ranch, we actually have enough barbecue pits to smoke roast prime rib for 1,200 lucky folks. When our crew slices the beef, it further wows diners because each slice covers most of the plate. It's worth noting that prime rib is the full rack from which ribeye steaks are cut. When cut into individual steaks, you get more crustiness in proportion to the meat because a steak is grilled on both sides, but a large prime rib is going to brown just on the outer edges. Both can be delicious. It's a personal preference. We like more pepper in our prime rib rub because with its higher fat content and larger surface area, the prime rib can handle a more piquant rub. Combine all the rub ingredients in a small bowl and mix well. Place the roast on a baking sheet. Massage the dry rub all over the roast, really packing it on. Let set at room temperature while getting the smoker ready. Fire up the smoker, bringing the temperature to 300 degrees to 325 degrees. Logs should be burned down to large coals before adding them to the fire. You'll want to do this in some kind of fireproof barrel or tub. Add more coals as needed throughout the hours of smoking to maintain the proper temperature. Before cooking, take the internal temperature of the meat deep in the roast center with an instant read thermometer. The temperature should be nearing 40 degrees, considered the high end of the safe range for beef to sit out unrefrigerated. If the temperature of the roast is more than a couple of degrees below 40 degrees, plan to extend the cooking time by a few minutes. Transfer the prime rib to the smoker, fattier side up. Plan on a total cooking time of 2 to 2.5 hours. After 1.5 hours, check the internal temperature, deep in the roast center again, to gauge the rest of the cooking time. You don't want to overcook a piece of meat this special. We prefer to take the roast off when it is in the rare to medium rare range, 100 degrees, 120 degrees to 130 degrees. We don't advise cooking it beyond 140 degrees, the high side of medium. Although you might want to cook the roast just to 140 degrees so that you have prime rib of varying doneness. Tent the roast loosely with aluminum foil and let sit for 30 minutes. Allowing the roast to rest is essential, so all the meat's juices settle and aren't lost when the roast is sliced. Carve into thick slices and serve. Bourbon glazed carrots. Serves 6. 1 pound baby carrots. 1/2 teaspoon kosher salt. Plus more to taste. 1/4 cup packed brown sugar. 1/4 teaspoon ground cinnamon. Pinch or 2 cayenne. 1/4 cup coarsely chopped pecans. 4 tablespoons salted butter, cut up into small pieces. 2 tablespoons bourbon. Bring a medium saucepan of water to a boil. Add the carrots and salt, reduce the heat to a simmer, and cook for 8 to 10 minutes until the carrots can just be pierced with a fork. drain in a colander, and return the carrots to the pan. While the carrots are cooking, stir together the brown sugar, cinnamon, and cayenne in a bowl. Toast the pecans in a dry skillet over medium-low heat, stirring often so they don't burn, until they are aromatic. Set aside. Stir the butter into the warm carrots and return to low heat. When melted, add the bourbon. Then stir in the brown sugar mixture. Continue cooking, stirring frequently, until the carrots are glazed and tender. Add salt to taste. Top the glazed carrots with the pecans and serve. Cheddar pecan cheese straws. Makes about 4 dozen. 1/2 cup, 1 stick, salted butter at room temperature. 4 ounces sharp cheddar, shredded and at room temperature. 1 1/4 cups all-purpose flour. 1/2 teaspoon kosher salt. 1/2 teaspoon cayenne. 1/2 cup finely chopped pecans. Place the butter and cheese in the bowl of a stand mixer and cream on high speed for several minutes until completely blended. Stop the mixer, scrape down the sides, and add the flour, salt, and cayenne. Beat again on medium speed until the dry ingredients are incorporated. Scrape the dough out onto a work surface. Scatter the pecans over the dough and work them into the dough. Divide and roll the dough into 2 logs, about the diameter of 1/4. Roll the logs in wax paper and twist the ends. Chill thoroughly in the refrigerator for at least 2 hours or up to 1 week. Well-wrapped logs can be frozen up to 1 month. Let them come to room temperature before slicing. Heat the oven to 350 degrees. Line 2 baking sheets with parchment paper. Cut the logs into 1/4 inch thick slices. Rotate the dough 1/4 turn after slicing about 6 straws to keep the shape even, repeating as needed. Arrange the straws about 1/2 inch apart on the lined baking sheets. Bake for 8 to 10 minutes, just until set and golden. Serve warm or at room temperature. Store in a tin or other covered container for up to 1 week. Pear Cranberry Crisp. Serves 8. 1/2 cup all-purpose flour. 1/2 cup packed brown sugar. 1/4 cup chopped pecans. 1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon. 1/4 cup, 1/2 stick salted butter, cubed, at room temperature. 4 large ripe pears, preferably Anjou or Bartlett. 4 ounces fresh or thawed frozen cranberries. 4 teaspoons granulated sugar. Heat the oven to 375 degrees. Butter a 9-inch square baking dish. Combine the flour, brown sugar, pecans, and cinnamon in a food processor. Give the processor a couple of pulses to combine a bit. Add the butter and pulse until the mixture is an evenly crumbly meal. Peel the pears, then slice each lengthwise in half and core. If the pear halves are roly-poly, slice a very thin bit off each rounded side so that they sit still in the baking dish. Place the pears in the dish, cut side up. Mound 1/8 of the cranberries in the hollow of each pear half and sprinkle each with 1/2 teaspoon granulated sugar. Spoon the topping over the pears evenly, mounding it over each pear and packing it down lightly. Scatter any remaining cranberries and topping around the pears. Bake the crisp for 40 to 45 minutes until the topping is crunchy and the pears and cranberries are tender. Serve warm.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.